As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Alison Rudd, sitting in for the Easter bonnet decorating Gab Marcotti. Today we'll be talking about a seismic Premier League weekend. I'm joined in a packed, some might say stuffy, studio by James Scowcroft, James Gearbrandt and Julien Laurent. And it's a room full of Jameses because I do believe that Julien is French for James, isn't it?
No.
I thought so.
It's a good try.
Lots to munch through, whether prey line filled or not. But we start at White Hart Lane. We're going to discuss Spurs' 4-0 demolition of Watford, which might seem like a one-sided discussion, but we will get on to what sort of season Watford have had and are having. But first of all, one of the reasons I really wanted to discuss this game, even though it was slightly one-sided, is because I did an Easter egg hunt for some neighbours. And the little boy, he's 8, and he's a Man United fan, and he's going up to Old Trafford today for a tour. But he started to really care about Spurs. And I said, if you were a young sports fan right now, no matter what your affiliations are, if you're young enough, you will be seduced by Spurs. There's something about the fact they have a lovely manager who's very smiley. They are a team that seem very united. They are, most of all, incredibly young. There are some great stats in today's game in a piece by Gary Jacob on just how phenomenal the phenomenal level of progress that Dele Alli has made. And depending on when you're listening to this, I mean, he's 21 on Tuesday. So, I mean, it is remarkable. But let's discuss that hypothesis that they are, at the moment, everyone's favourite other team. James Scowcroft looks cynical. Go on. Do you see where I'm going?
I think your 8-year old friend, as soon as he walks out and sees a Theatre of Dreams, will, his soft spot for Tottenham will disappear overnight. I think they're everyone's favourite second team because they haven't won the Premier League. I think maybe it's people like something new. We all loved Leicester last year. Listen, Tottenham are a great side, and I think if you look at their result at the weekend, they actually played very well and had a lot of their key players missing as well. There's some big players out. For me, the test for Tottenham is they couldn't handle it last year when the pressure was on and everyone thought, could they catch Leicester? And there was a time where you thought maybe they could, and it didn't happen. There's no pressure on them at the moment. I'm just thinking, would it be a different story if they had pressure, like the Champions League, where they failed miserably this year? Is that the acid test?
They did fail miserably in Europe. It was actually
quite
embarrassing, but that's part of my point. It doesn't seem to matter what anomalies they throw up. There is something very arresting about their joie de vivre. Go on, Julien. I've said a French word, so you've got to.
No, but I think they've had the most remarkable season. More than, for me, their achievement, you know, if they keep going like this and Leicester finish second, is better than Chelsea, considering they played in Europe, which is an extra 8 games compared to Chelsea. Considering their transfer window in the summer was not that great, if you look at Janssen and Sissoko, okay, Wanyama, great signing, but Janssen and Sissoko, two huge failures for them. So, and yet they're there, and I think they've played some of the best football this season, and I think they totally deserve that. If you think about it, best defence, again, third best attack, one goal scored less than Chelsea, for example. Only 3 defeats, Chelsea have 4, for example, and United have only 3 defeats as well. So they've, I think it's been remarkable, and I think you can see the progression year after year. And they had that deep in form, didn't they, at the end of October, November, where they drew 4 in a row, which cost them dearly. Now you can see that, because if they've just won 1 of those 4, for example, or 2 even, with a defeat and another draw, they would be clearly competing with Chelsea for the title. But that period is also because Pochettino makes them work so hard through the summer and at the start of the season that they will always have a dip, and Dele Alli had a similar dip as well in terms of form at the end of November and beginning of December. But I think they've been incredible this season.
Let me just quote what... It's actually probably not always a good idea to quote people for whom English is not their first language. Maybe Pochettino didn't mean it quite like this, but I felt it was very telling. Pochettino was talking about how he decided to be really lovely and nurturing of Ali after he got sent off in the Europa League. And he said, many people criticised me, da, da, da. We were right to support him, give him love. When you are winning and you feel that to lose on the pitch is like losing your life, that is all we want in a player. Which seems to me to possibly sum up what Pochettino does with those young players. If he sees that instinct in them, he'll bend over backwards to make sure that they can show that every week on the pitch. James, as someone young, do you get that? Do you get what that means?
Well, I think one thing that really impresses me about Spurs, whenever I see them, is there's that real sense of unity and cohesion in the squad. I think watching Spurs more than watching any other team, you know, when they score a goal and they celebrate together, you get a real sense of mates playing together. And maybe that is because they are, you know, they are quite young, you know, the likes of Ali and Dier and Kane and so on. I know Eriksen is not maybe as young, but you do get that sense of mates playing together. And I think what that has contributed to is their resilience and adversity. There was a stat that since Pochettino joined Spurs, they've won more points from losing positions than any other team by some considerable margin, I think. And also, I think that's shown if you look at their record without Harry Kane this season. He should be a talismanic figure, and of course he is, but in eight games without him, they're unbeaten. They've won five and drawn three.
But Scowie, I mean, I think I agree with everything James just said there, and I'm calling you Scowie all the time because there's too many. I like Scowie, though. No, sounds a bit more woolly back.
You can call me what you want.
Scary. I agree with everything James just said, but as a coach, is that something you can create artificially? Or is Pochettino just got lucky that he's got a group of guys there who do feel like they're part of something more than just another football team?
Well, no, I think James makes a good point. They're all at a young age and they sort of play in with that sort of no fear, really. The more experience you get sometimes the more sort of fear, you're more aware of what's going on, the pressure. For me, Tottenham have been impressive in the last couple of seasons. This isn't a one-off. I thought they had a good season last year, although they fell away. They still need to go to a Chelsea, an Arsenal, a United or City and put in a big performance and a big win. I think that's the next test, and I'm not sure this team is really capable of it.
Our very own Henry Winters pointed out that three of the last four PFA Young Players of the Year have been Spurs players. Julien, do you fully expect this year's Young Player of the Year to come from White Hart Lane as well?
Yeah, will Dele Alli be into Young Players of the Year?
Yeah,
he will be, I guess, yeah. Yeah, no, and I think their academy is good. They have very good, talented scouts that identify young talent if they're not already at the academy, like Dele Alli. I mean, Dele Alli was very good at MK Dons, although probably a bit inconsistent at the time because he was so young. But I think it was quite clear for everybody to see that he was a special talent back then already. But in fairness, you know, Spurs won the race to sign him and credit to them. But they've done that, you know, with a few very good young players as well. So they deserve a lot of credit, as Pochettino, like James and you've said, deserve credit for developing those young talent and improving them. Like, I mean, when I see Danny, even Kyle Walker, when I see him play nine, and he's far from the finished article because there's still a lot of things to improve, especially defensively. But Pochettino has transformed him, you know, I think, and same with Danny Rose, probably even more Danny Rose, I think. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. He certainly has a great touch with young players.
He gives them a chance, doesn't he?
Which, it's not just a chance, though, is it?
Well, it is. The chance is the biggest thing.
Yeah, yeah. Because you can play them and they might not develop.
Yeah, but if you look at Chelsea, you look at Man City, they've got far, far stronger youth teams than what Tottenham have, but they don't get an opportunity, where at Tottenham they do. And I think that's credit to Pochettino, that when he does see an opening, they've used the Europa League very well in the last few seasons to give their youngsters a chance. But he will put them in, and he's not frightened to know. You know, I know Dele Alli hasn't come through their academy, but Harry Winks, Josh Onoma is a very good player coming through. Harry Kane, was a prime example, really, where he just came from nowhere and all of a sudden he's one of the best strikers in Europe, really. So I think that's credit to Pochettino, what he's done with young players, similar to Ferguson in his day.
Just two things on Dele Alli. First one, can we please stop comparing with Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard and Paul
Scholes?
No, you, but people in general in this country love a comparation. Can we please stop it? Dele Alli is not playing like Steven Gerrard.
Are you
Frank
trying
Lampard.
To say, is what you're trying to say, he is what he is? Is that
yeah,
what you're trying to say?
Yeah, and if you don't think that he's playing like some, at least if you want to compare with players who played like him before. And if you don't think anyone played like him before, just don't compare then. Because it's stupid to compare him with Paul Scholes. Anyway, second point, I saw Hugo Lloris before the Euros last season. And he said to me, do you like Dele Alli? I said, yeah, I really like him. He said, you've seen nothing yet. You've seen nothing. Because next season and the seasons after, he's going to be even better than what you've seen this season.
A word on, as promised, on Watford. There seems to be general consensus we might not see Walter Mazzarri next season. And he's dared to annoy Troy Deeney by keeping him on the bench till the 70th minute at White Hart Lane. I think part of the problem with Mazzarri is that he doesn't speak English. Again, it's a good comparison because Pochettino wouldn't speak English when he was at Southampton and yet somehow managed to convey what he was really about and thinking and what his philosophy was and what sort of personality he was. And I felt you did get to know him even though he didn't speak in English. Whereas there's an aura about Mazzarri that makes it look like he's quite contained and he's probably accepting that he's not there for the long haul, which I don't think... Even though most managers are not, they should act like they are. But, you know, can you blame Watford's owners because they seem to have struck a way of just making sure they don't get into trouble anymore in the Premier League? Scoey, do you agree with that little summation?
I think when a manager doesn't speak English, if he's not performing well, that's always going to catch up with him, isn't it? I think you have to make a real... intent to learn the language there. It, for me, Watford just seems a club that on some levels work. You know, I'm looking at the table now, the 10th, 37 points, well clear of relegation, not going to go down, which is the biggest box that's ticked, but it just seems a club that's controlled at the top, not at managerial level. And I think if you last over a year at Watford as a manager, you've done quite well.
Any love for Watford?
No.
No.
Just leaving Deeney and Capu on the bench makes no sense.
Well, show us strength. I think so.
He's playing on the training, he said.
He's trying to prove a point there, isn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know if you have. I know for fans didn't have to travel a lot far to go to Spurs. But if you're a fan and your captain is on the bench for no reason, it's not like even you were resting him for a huge game the following, you know, 4 days later or something, I would be really cross.
The other James said that they're safe, but just say 38 points or 39 are what give you safety this season. Do they not look like a team, Watford, who could go on that unthinkable, not get another point?
Plummet towards relegation.
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely, to be honest, although it is close down there and the margin in terms of points is not necessarily as big as you might think it would be in terms of position. But I think Watford are probably safe, and I'm going to give Watford a little bit of credit because I think what they've done, which I think is quite kind of remarkable, is they've really overturned the traditional kind of orthodoxy on how, you know, a club is supposed to come up from the second tier and stay in the top flight and quite comfortably at that, certainly in their first season. You know, they had a very high turnover of players, certainly from their promotion season to the Premier League season, and then again to a probably slightly lesser extent between these two seasons. I've had a high turnover of managers. Jokanović took them up, and then Kike Sanchez Flores did, to most people's judgment, very good job last year, and then they, you know, let him go as well. Mazzarri is in charge, but it's not clear whether he will stay. So they don't have any of the sort of continuity that people usually think of as being necessary to kind of establish a club in the top flight. But I think at the moment, I mean, they're 10th, they're in the top half. I mean, you'd have to say they're probably slightly overachieving, certainly to most people's expectations, certainly to mine.
Right, to West Ham's narrow defeat of Swansea. This was billed as bigger than the Masters or something. There was a lot of hype around this game, and I was there, and it was a classic case of more hype than substance. I've seen both teams play 3,000% better than they played on Saturday. I felt I was in some sort of, I don't know, George Orwell world, because everyone kept banging on about how the fans were really going to help West Ham get out of their terrible predicament. They were looking at a possible sixth successive defeat, and the West Ham board had said that is unacceptable. So I was thinking, oh my God, we might see Slaven Bilic booted out today. It could be all, but they're saying, no, the fans will get behind us. It's going to be amazing. The atmosphere was pretty limp, really. It wasn't great. And West Ham won by virtue of being slightly less dreadful than Swansea. In my report in the game, I focused on the fact that just by virtue of one goal, West Ham are now targeting a top half of the table finish. Crisis over. So, James Gearbrandt, is the crisis over for West Ham?
I don't know if the crisis is over. You would say that they, you know, they still need a bit more to be absolutely certain of avoiding relegation. West Ham has been a very strange season. I mean, the last time I watched West Ham was when they won 3-1 at Southampton. And that was something like, you know, their third win in four games, and it took them up to ninth. They looked all set for another very good season. And since then, they've plummeted. One thing that is slightly worrying to me about Slaven Bilic and West Ham is they win and lose games in real streaks. It's a little bit, to me, a little bit reminiscent of Alan Pardew at Crystal Palace, or you know, in the kind of way they will have like an awful run, and then they always take one performance to turn it around, then they'll have a good run, and then suddenly they'll be back on a poor run. You never know quite what you're going to get. But overall, I think West Ham are doing okay this season. They're 14th. They, you know, lost Dimitri Payet. You know, if you'd said last season when Payet was so influential, where might they be without Payet? They had him up until January, but you would probably have said
he wasn't
around.
Really there, was he? He wasn't really
well,
there.
Quite. You would probably have said like maybe around there. So yeah. I don't know. No, I'm not inclined to judge Bilic that harshly as I know some people are.
He's hard to dislike. He's so engaging, and he's one of those managers that will answer every question properly and not sort of get cross if he doesn't like what you're asking. But the streakiness is interesting, Scoey. Last season, they were building up to a Champions League finish, for goodness sake. Then the start of this season, they were dreadful.
Side is one key element. So if you look at the side they had last year, I'm pretty certain it was a lot more settled than what it was this year. You have your star player is desperate to get out of the club. Your second star player is injured half the time. So yeah, there's no stability within the side there, which I think they've massively lacked this season. They've had new players come in. I think Jose Fonte hasn't really been the player that they thought they were getting. I don't think he's had a...
Who did they think they were getting?
I think they thought they were going to get...
Virgil van Dijk, is that who they thought?
No, I think they thought they were going to get... Fonte's been a fantastic player for Southampton, but for whatever reason hasn't settled at West Ham. I think they'll limp over the line. It's a massive result for them at the weekend, because not only did they win, but Swansea would have sort of crept up closer to them as well. I think they'll limp over the line. I think next season's a big season for Bilic. I think he needs to get it going in the opposite direction. If not, he won't be there.
Julian, do you think Bilic will be there next season?
I hope he is. I really like him. I really, really like him. I don't know, there's something about him I like, but I think Scurry is right. He's made mistakes. I think this season, defensively, they were awful for most of the first part of the season when they were really struggling. And I think that, you know, that I know James Collins doesn't help you when, you know, although he played really well, I think, at the weekend.
But he actually played really well against Arsenal as well.
Yeah, that's true. But, it's, you know, I think they lacked a bit of quality defensively. That's why they went and got Fonte, even if he maybe hasn't delivered yet what they wanted from him. But I think he's made mistakes, and I can see as well. I mean, the owners of the club are typically the kind of owners who thought after last season, that's it. You know, that's it. We're gonna finish fifth or try to get into the top four. I don't think they saw last year as, okay, maybe we really overachieved. And I think they're disappointed now that they're not doing this as well as last season. And
they didn't recruit well this season, did they? I think they massively underestimated going into the new stadium. I thought they thought that would kick them on. I think they've tried to do things on the cheap, basically. And I think it's got them in a little bit of a mess that Saturday's result got them out of, actually. I saw them recently when they played Leicester at home, and it was the whole set. It was the first visit to a West Ham first team game to Olympic Stadium. I just thought, this is just... it's a new era, but they were so behind what everything West Ham was starting for. It's a new start, and I just think they've totally underestimated the move, the way the fans have sort of been negative against it. And I think it'll take them a while to get everybody going in the right direction again.
So presumably, James, the answer would be to stick with Bilic and get that continuity we've already decided on the podcast is important, and
spend money,
learn how to cope. I mean, there's no point bringing in a new manager who has to learn all over again how to cope with the Olympic Stadium, for example, is there?
I mean, I agree. I like Bilic, as everyone else has already said, and my instinct would certainly be to keep him. I don't think he's done so badly that he deserves to be sacked by any means. What is arguably quite unfortunate for Bilic is that, and what will probably be quite worrying him in his private moments, is that this season in general is a season where clubs have been vindicated for changing manager. Most of the clubs that have changed manager were not quite, were in a more parlous situation than West Ham are now. But, you know, it's a season that for whatever reason has really shown that if you change manager, very often you will be rewarded. I mean, you look at Leicester, you look at Hull, Swansea, I know the effect has tailed off, but even them to a certain extent, Palace with Allardyce. As I say, West Ham are not doing as badly as any of those clubs are, but I just think that the effect nonetheless has been quite amply demonstrated.
Well, thank you for mentioning Swansea, because that allows us to move there. And in fact, that's the theme with Swansea, isn't it? They look like they had jettisoned Bob Bradley in time. Paul Clement comes in, loses his first game in charge against Arsenal, badly, but hey, we'll forgive him that because new team and everything. And then suddenly they look like, you know, they can beat Liverpool, they can beat anybody. You're reminded that the Swansea have a tradition of passing football, and they let that build their confidence, and they have the league's most beautiful player in Gylfi Sigurdsson. What could possibly go wrong? And their new manager bounce is over. And after the game on Saturday, I think Paul Clement used the word anxiety 64 times, possibly.
Really?
Because that's the only thing he could think of why they played so badly. They were very anxious. So obviously we asked him, what do you do to get rid of the anxiety? And he didn't know. He did say, I don't believe in sports psychologists. Doesn't think that's the answer. He thinks
that's
the answer lies on the training ground. So what
totally.
Do we...
I think that comes from someone that hasn't played the game and doesn't have the experience. I think the mental side of football is what gets you over the line, and that line could be 3 points, it could be survival. I just think that's a very naive statement.
So if Clement phones you up and says, eek, what do I do? You would say, what? What should he do? What sort of psychological help would you give a team in that situation?
Well, it's all about belief, isn't it? You look at a team that's full of confidence and they'll most likely be going towards the top of the league. You look at Sunderland. You take Sunderland as a prime example. I watched them yesterday, devout of any confidence whatsoever, and I've been there myself as a player. So to come out of that statement saying that psychology in football is not really an issue, it's all about what you do on the training ground, is absolute nonsense.
Maybe if you start by starting from the Llorente on Saturday in a game of that importance.
But I saw how bad Llorente was when he did come on.
Well, yeah, maybe, but that doesn't mean he would have been bad if he'd started the game. I just don't understand why you had something that was working with him. Clearly, he got you a lot of points since you've taken over, and then you drop him for that game.
He's not been fit in training.
Yeah, no, I know, but he's still better than Jordan Ayew. I mean, Ayew playing against his brother, well, great story, but Llorente is far better than Ayew and far more useful to in an away game, I think, especially. And I think him and Gylfi are great together. I don't know. I was surprised he left him on the bench, even if he was not 100% fit.
Yeah.
Because I think in a game, I mean, in all those games now, you just can't afford not to have your best players, even not 100% on the pitch.
What do we think has happened? Because every manager comes in and has their tweaks on how you train and their rules and regulations and how they speak to players, and it clearly worked. I suspect part of it, unfortunately, from Swansea's perspective, might simply be that he wasn't American. And they were just all relieved that Bradley, which was an experiment that didn't work, had gone. I have heard the players just, they didn't down tools, but they were slightly mystified by his approach.
Yeah.
Clement comes in, far more straightforward, more like speaking their language, if you like, but he's not been able to maintain it for very long at all. So what do we think has gone wrong?
I think the Spurs defeat was a huge blow. I think that they thought they were going to win that game, and those 3 points would have been
Why
incredible.
Would you think you're going to beat Spurs?
Because it's the 89th minute and you're 1-0 up and you're at home, and you know, although you're under pressure, but there's still, there's 3 minutes of fighting, and then you're there. And I think losing the way they did, although they were probably not the best team on the day, losing the way they did in the last few
but
minutes.
But they were like not that, good going into that game.
No, but if you win that, that could be the turning point. Instead, you think you're about to win it, and instead you get battered in the last 4 minutes. You go from, okay, this is, like I said, maybe a turning point, and suddenly you're, okay, we're still where we were before. I think those 4 minutes could have made a huge difference.
Well, that's really the isn't that the clever part of management, that somehow you twist that into saying, come on, we were so good for 90 minutes, let's make sure we defeat
West Ham.
I'm sure
the next morning, when they went to training the next morning, they must have
been from the Premier League twice, and that has happened to me so often, where you concede late goals and you go from winning positions to losing positions. And what happens, it's a knock-on effect for individuals, for the team, the crowd. So all of a sudden you get to 75, 80 minutes and you start defending deep, and there's a few misplaced passes, everyone's gasping and moaning and I just think it's a cycle that you get into, and Swansea are back in it, unfortunately, and they need to dig themselves out, because at this moment in time, I would say at the bottom, basically out of Swansea, Hull or Palace, isn't it? I would say Swansea look the favourites to go down.
I think one of Swansea's big problems is they don't really have any really reliable centre-backs. And I know I'm being a bit harsh there, but, you know, for all Alfie Mawson's improvements this season and his eye for goal, he's not really... He has a lot of rawness to his game. He's not a kind of ultra-solid, reliable centre-back that you can rely on week in, week out in the Premier League. Fernandez, for a player of his pedigree, has never really quite lived up to what he maybe should be in the Premier League. Jordi Amat is a bit of a liability. They've got Van der Hoorn as well, but I mean, they are weak in that position, I think. And if you look at the amount of goals they've conceded, I mean, it's the most by a long way. And I think, you know, there are various stats flying around that teams that have conceded that number of goals at this stage of the season do not stay up.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And so to our debate. They can't all finish in the top four. So let's discuss who needs it most. Or, indeed, put it the other way, who will suffer least by not qualifying for next season's Champions League? This isn't quite as stupid as it sounds. We all know they all want to be there, and the fans will be devastated, and the managers will be cross, and the owners will be peeved. But there are six, maybe seven teams who really think they've got enough class and history and spent enough money to qualify for the Champions League. Let's assume we don't have to talk about Chelsea and Tottenham. Let's talk, first of all, about Liverpool. How bad would it be for Jurgen Klopp, given he came to these shores as an enigmatic miracle worker? He's had no diversions this season. They score for fun. Surely they have to be in the Champions League next season, don't they, James Gearbrand?
I think it would be a big blow for Liverpool to...
But bigger than anyone else? We're going to have to rate them at the end.
Well, put it this way. I think at the start of the season, if you'd said Liverpool would qualify for the Champions League, to me, that would be... I don't know if I would say an overachievement, but to me, that would be a really good achievement for Jurgen Klopp. That would be a real tangible sign of progress from his first season. They've not really got as good a squad as some of the other teams competing for the Champions League places. They certainly don't have the depth of some of their rivals. But I just think psychologically now, they've been in the box seat for a top four place for a while. It's very like they've had it within their grasp. And I think psychologically now, to slip out of the top four would be a real crushing blow.
It would also, presumably, Julian, it would mean that their bench would look even more rubbish next season. I mean, how are they going to attract... Sometimes I look at Liverpool's bench and I think, well, that's... I don't know how they are in the top four.
I know. And if you look at Julian Draxler, who chose PSG over Liverpool in January, if you look at Mo Dahoud, who's one of the most promising players in the Bundesliga, who decided to go to Dortmund at the end of the season instead of, again, rejected Liverpool in a way, to go to Dortmund, shows you that already now, when they can finish top four and qualify for the Champions League next season, they're already struggling to attract the players they want. If there's no Champions League next season, they might love Klopp, they might love the idea of playing for Liverpool and the stadium and the fans and some great players in that team, but they might think, I want to play Champions League football, and you couldn't blame them for that as well. So I think that it would be a huge blow in terms of, again, for the standing of the club and how big the club is. You just can't have those years without Champions League. But like you said, for the future as well, to recruit players and to keep hold of your Coutinho. I mean, Coutinho is not going to stay there forever if there's no Champions League football at some point. And Firmino, you could think, might feel exactly the same, and same with other stars in this team. So I think it's crucial, I think
Lallana went to Anfield for European football, didn't he?
And I think it's crucial more for them than for everybody else, I think, in that fight to finish in the top four.
Scoey, did you feel that the way they came back against Stoke, which is not something Liverpool do very often, actually, they usually struggle if it's not going well there, shows that they know they're in a fight for top four, they're prepared to
Well, they're in the top four, aren't they? They're third, and I think it's a massive win, especially coming from behind, away from home against Stoke. It's not easy. I think it's probably a win that will get them into the top four, really. They can score goals. They're running... isn't too bad. The next three games are West Brom, Palace, Watford, so all three games there are more than winnable. I think Liverpool will get in. The two top teams that will hurt the most, do you want my answer?
Give me the one you think it will hurt the most. We'll move on to that one then.
Both the Manchester clubs. It'll hurt United. It'll probably hurt City the most.
I agree. It would hurt City the most. So let's talk about City. Go on. Why do you think? Why would you inch towards City?
Well, I think
City?
If you look at United last year, they proved the myth of, oh God, if you're not in the Champions League, you can't do this. Manchester United recorded a world record turnover last year, not being in the Champions League. Financially, it's a blow, but it's not that big a blow if compared to the Premier League revenues that the clubs get in this country. So I just think Manchester City is all based on this Pep Guardiola coming over and winning the Champions League, and this fairy tale for them not to be in it would be a big blow.
Blow to Pep Guardiola or two?
Just a blow to the whole club.
It'd be really interesting to see what it would do to Guardiola personally, to his own kind of confidence in his own methods, because having had an almost unbroken run of success in his managerial career, certainly in terms of his league finishes, it's been... First, second, first. To suddenly go and finish fifth would be a real kind of like...
Or sixth.
Or, perish the thought sixth.
I was in Manchester last week and my City-supporting taxi driver said, we don't mind if we don't make the top four, because we can see what Pep's trying to do. He's building a long-term project. He'll get loads of money, and he will. He'll get lots of money to spend in the summer. He'll bring in players that suit his model and his system.
Can they? Because financial fair play will always... Manchester United turn over £200 million more than Man City. So United will always have that financial clout now that City won't, due to financial fair play.
But he's not going to get sacked, and he's not going to be backed in the market by his owners. He's preparing the ground for that. So you could perversely argue, in terms of implications over the summer of not making it into the Champions League, would hurt him the least on a personal level?
I think
the vibe is he's going to be given time to build.
Yeah, he will. But I think he takes everything so personally and so intensely that he will feel really, really bad, I think, if they don't finish in the top four. And like James said, if he finish fifth or sixth, it's a proper humiliation. I think for him not to go through in the Champions League already to the quarterfinals was something like, well, for the first time in his career, was like, wow, okay. If they, after that, were to finish sixth in the Premier League, even for his first season, even, you know, discovering the new league, etc., I think it would be an absolute disgrace for a club like City with the money they've spent already, for the squad they have. They should finish top four every single day, especially with a manager like Pep. But your taxi driver friend, I'm sorry, but
he's not the my
only
friend.
No, I know, but the only team in the whole of the Premier League not to have kept at least once the same starting 11 is something from... where is that coming from? Changing the team every single game. I don't understand how you expect to have great results if you keep twisting and changing and doing new things and thinking you're clever by moving him there. And what about Zabaleta as a number six? What about Yaya Toure as a goalkeeper maybe? It's just, I don't understand. And then if you finish six and turn and say, yeah, but it's okay because we don't need Champions League, we don't need this. I don't know. I would find that incredible.
Yeah,
I think that the point is that you can talk about, you know, the project that Pep is building, the long-term view, but, I mean, it's a hypothetical situation, obviously, but were they to finish fifth or sixth, surely that undermines faith in the whole project. Even for a coach of Guardiola's incredibly sort of, like, vaunted reputation, to finish fifth this season with that squad, I mean, that's got to kind of have people thinking a little bit.
No, but he's been very clever, because he's taken players like Aguero and said, they're not quite good enough.
He had 18 months to think about his squad and to build the squad. Kevin De Bruyne was brought because Pep said, yeah, I fancy him. Leroy Sané was brought in the summer because it was Pep's choice. So he had a long time to think about his squad. So I don't get the idea of, yeah, but look at the squad he got. And it would be a huge failure for me if they don't finish in that top four. And even if they finish fourth, I think that would be not a very good season.
I suspect if they don't finish in the top four, it'll be people like us who are appalled and surprised and aghast. But within the walls of City, they'll cope.
Gabriel called it at the start of the season.
For that reason, they have to finish in the top four. Otherwise, we'll hear it for the next 10 years.
And what about Mourinho? Will his ego cope okay not finishing in the top four? I suppose it's complicated at United because they could win quite a lot of silverware and finish outside the
horribly
top
wrong
of the
league. Or all come together for Mourinho. And if he does win the Europa League and the League Cup in his first season, then it's some statement as well. I think it'd be a massive blow for United because this is now getting a regular occurrence, not finishing in the top four. And at some stage, that trend has got to break, but I just think as a club, they can still pull in like a Pogba they did last season. They can still go out and buy the top players.
And how do we all feel about the club spokesman being Zlatan these days? And
you
what
know,
he
when
says
he was
goes?
In France, he would never, ever talk. Or very rarely, but never stop in the mix zone, never do TV interviews after the games. And here, every time I turn my TV on, he's there. And it's just like, wow. It's crazy. And you know, even in France, he could have done... He didn't have to do it in French. In English would have been fine, but no, he always refused.
Ooh, that's interesting. So do you think the club are asking him to speak? Do they think he's a wonderful face to put forward?
Maybe. I don't know exactly what they do, but United, historically, are a club where it's very difficult to get, you know, interviews and players to talk. And you see Paul Pogba has hardly done anything this season, apart from maybe a couple of TV interviews. But for Zlatan, clearly, I don't know, and maybe he feels so vindicated by the fact that before coming here, everybody was saying like, oh, he's too old and it's so easy to score goals in France and in Italy that he will never do it on a Tuesday night at Stoke, blah, 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 all that rubbish, that he feels so happy by his season. And rightly so, I think if I was him, I would talk even more to remind people that they doubted him and he proved everybody wrong. But yeah.
Is it too cynical to suggest that when Zlatan speaks, United sell more merchandise? He's a money-making figurehead?
I think when he scores, they sell more merchandise. It all comes together, doesn't it? If he scores, he speaks, they sell. You know, that's what Manchester United's all about, isn't it? It's about the revenue streams and iconic players. And to be fair to him, he's carried it off very well this year, hasn't he?
the run of fixtures that United have, he's by far and
United
miles ahead.
By finishing the top four.
The most difficult when no they chance. Have to play obviously
Chelsea
City,
next.
Chelsea and Spurs. And
they have to go to Arsenal, they have to go to Tottenham, they have to go to Man City. They've got Chelsea at home. It's
a crazy run of fixtures compared to the others as well in that race. Plus the
so
Europa
he may
League
as well prioritise the Europa League then.
But I don't know how
if you were him, would you?
I think you'll see it. They've got Anderlecht on Thursday. I think you'll see a very, very strong Manchester United side.
But what, and not next weekend then? Or you try to do the strong?
No, I think he'll work backwards. I think the Europa League will come as a priority now. If you look at the Europa League, the teams in it, you know, Manchester United are the standout favourites. So you get into the semi-finals, you're only three games from winning it, really. So that'll be close, and that will be the best option for him. And I just think he'll get to a point in the league where the problem with Manchester United and Mourinho, he can't go to Man City away and play a weakened side. You can't. It's Manchester United. It's Mourinho. It's Chelsea's at home as well. I'm sure he'd love to beat Chelsea at Old Trafford, but the fixture list for United is ridiculous.
Well, we don't need to spend too long on Arsenal because I think we discussed on the podcast many times that Wenger has never failed to make the top four. So you could make a case that that is the most seismic outcome longer term.
We've talked hours about Arsene Wenger.
Oh, let's not bother then. Okay, so in I think it divides up into which manager would suffer the most in terms of reputation, which club would suffer the most. I think Pep would suffer the most in terms of reputation. I think Liverpool would suffer the most in terms of what it means longer term in attracting players, and they need them more than anyone else. Sounds like United are going to cope quite well. Arsenal will just be a different club altogether next season if they don't finish. But a lot of people say that's a good thing. Let's go to quick hits. So, chaps, nice, succinct answers, please. I don't do sound effects to chivvy you along because I know that you are very obedient on this section of the show. Diego Costa was reasonably unimpressive against Bournemouth. Scoey, why does Antonio Conte indulge him so?
I think he's a key figure, isn't he? He hasn't been a standout player for Chelsea this year, but I think if you take him out of their team, you lose a lot of what Chelsea are good about. Still scored 17 goals so far in the Premier League, probably on target to score 20 goals. But maybe his future's away from the bridge. Who knows?
I think it probably is. Sunderland lose again and have now gone over 11 hours without a Premier League goal. Any hope at all for the Black Cats, James Gearbrand?
Well, I was asked this question about 3 weeks ago and I said no hope then, so I can't really change my tune now based on the recent events. I continue to be slightly surprised that I think David Moyes has got, I mean, leave the whole recent controversy aside, I think David Moyes has got surprisingly easy ride this year. Everyone sort of seems to expect it from, I don't know, maybe everyone kind of thinks that, you know, Sunderland was, you know, a job that he shouldn't have taken in the first place. For someone who had, you know, a very, very good managerial reputation before Manchester United, I was sort of fully expecting him to kind of rehabilitate it to some extent at Sunderland, and I've continued to be surprised by just how awful they are.
I think part of the reason he's been given a relatively easy ride is because everyone knows the owner likes him. And if you know there's no sniff of a sacking, you sort of just think, oh, well, can't be bothered. Hull veer from brave to insipid. Is it just a case of Marco Silva still finding his feet in the Premier League, Julian?
Yeah, yes and no. I think the home form was always going to be the key in their fight against relegation. And I think they've done that really well. And I'm a huge fan, as listeners will know, of Marco Silva. And his home record over the last three seasons or four seasons is incredible because he's still unbeaten. And again, I think until the end of the season, if they pick the points at home, they should be okay. But the games are coming, you know, Stoke away and Watford at home and Southampton away the next three will be so important. And they need to keep playing like they did at the weekend.
Scoey, Claude Puel has not been overly popular on the South Coast, but he's at least made sure his team are not coasting. See what I did there? Out the end of the season. I put dot, dot, dot. That means you fill in.
You hear rumours that he hasn't been popular. Obviously, haven't seen enough of Southampton week in and week out to find out why they're ninth in the league, 40 points. Not quite sure where their sort of expectations were to, but not sure he could have done a lot more. It's been a good week for them. An excellent home result against Palace and then a wonderful away win at West Brom. So I can't really see. There's a lot more managers that are under a lot more pressure than Mr. Poyel, Julian's mate.
Why is he not popular?
No, he's just not made that connection with a lot of supporters.
A lot of French people have that problem.
Is it because he's too introvert or something compared to, I don't know, Posh, for example, because he... is it the language barrier?
Partly his personality.
They haven't scored a lot of goals, have they? Especially
and partly
at home,
his decisions on who he plays and the style and lack of goals, as James says. Middlesbrough have contributed, if nothing else, an amazing 7 goalless draws this season. Is that why, JG? Do you like being called JG? JG.
It's acceptable.
JG. No one will care if they are relegated.
They haven't really won the neutrals over. I must say the worst game I've watched all season was one of those when they drew 0-0 against West Brom. That was a terrible, terrible game. Middlesbrough came up, I was sort of quite excited about them. You know, you look on paper, they had some good players. You know, you've got Ramirez, Stuani, and then obviously they bought some good players in the summer, like Negredo. It hasn't really happened for them. I don't know, I don't think it's any more noble to be, you know, for example, Swansea, who have scored a lot more goals than Middlesbrough, but also conceded. You know, you have to find a balance, don't you? You have to find a way of winning enough games to stay up, and they haven't done it, and I don't think they are going to stay up.
I look at the League One table in France and see Monaco have a goal difference, talking of goal difference, of 62, having scored 88 goals. Mm. Julien, they must be everyone's second team in France.
You cannot not like them. They've been so good all season, so attacking, so sexy to watch, and all those goals and Falcao and Mbappe and
Lema. But are they popular in France?
They are popular. Yeah. And rightly so, and because you can only be seduced by the talent that is there, and the way they play as well is fantastic. I mean, I love them, but not as much as PSG, obviously, and I still hope that PSG will win the title, but it's a great title race.
Who will win it?
That we have PSG every day.
Do you think?
3 points, 7 games to go. Monaco have to go to Lyon, for example, which is not going to be an easy game. It's going to be fantastic. And it's going to be really like, because the goal difference, as you said, is an extra point.
So they can afford to lose one game.
They can afford to lose one game, indeed. And PSG have to win everything. So we'll see. Ali, one for you. David Moyes is, as we speak on Monday morning, letting the FA know why he spoke as he did to BBC reporter Vicky Sparks. But what was your reaction to the Sunderland manager's post-match comments?
Well, this is a game podcast exclusive because I turned down all requests to comment on this from other outlets. I won't bore you with the reasons why, you can probably guess. But what I would say is I thought the comments were creepy, most of all, and patronising. But the point I'd like to make is I really think it ought to have been up to Vicky Sparks to decide whether this was in the public domain, whether we were all discussing it. It was leaked from a colleague at the BBC, as far as I can make out. And it's to become public property for an off-the-record, off-camera comment when you're doing your job it's out of line for this to become. It might make her career very difficult. And the next time you see her on the telly, it'll be, oh, that's Vicky Sparks. Isn't she the one that ... It's up to the person who was slighted or didn't feel slighted to make it an issue, not for the rest of us to pontificate and decide, because he didn't say it on camera. It was between him and her, and it was just a fact of the way technology works that it was recorded.
And she wasn't offended, was she?
I don't know. But the fact that she doesn't really want to talk about it, and she didn't complain and make... This doesn't come from her. This has come from someone else being angry on her behalf. But if it was me, I would be absolutely furious if one of my colleagues decided that a slight delivered to me after a game but caught on a tape recorder was then released into the public domain. It's up to me to decide if you all get angry about that or not. That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, James Scowcroft, James Gearbrandt and James Laron. Remember, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. And please press that subscribe button on wherever you choose to download your podcasts and leave a witty review on iTunes if you're listening on an Apple device.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.